Get ready to press record.
Vai marinheiro, vai, vai, vai buscar a Laurindinha. Vai marinheiro, vai, vai, ela é tua, não é minha. Sim, nosso é, com toda a certeza, o programa Atlantis, que transmitimos dos estúdios da CFRC, no quadrante 101.9 FM, em sistema de cabo 90.9, aos domingos das 18 às 20 horas, com locução de Eduardo Pereira.
Vai marinheiro, vai, vai, vai buscar...
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're bringing you a story about the time we bombed the Northern Lights.
So they sent up a rocket with 100 kilograms of explosives, basically H2O molecules, water, and exploded it in the Aurora Borealis band. Within 2 seconds, they had created a 40 kilometer wide hole in the Aurora Borealis.
Wait for that. Two things I learned from the story that you're about to hear. One is that yes, Canada bombed the Aurora Borealis. Two, the Northern Lights make noises. Sometimes. And that is about as newsy and informational as things are going to get. Because as you will hear, today's episode sounds a little bit different. It's a little bit more poetic than our regularly scheduled programming. It's a bit more disco music, also, than you'll usually hear on Canada Land. But I really like it. And that's all I'm going to say. This is a story brought to us by documentarians Nicolas Lachapelle and Eloise Demers-Pinard, who traveled to Churchill, Manitoba, and beyond in order to try to record the sound of the Northern Lights. Happy holidays. Wait for it.
If you tune in a very sensitive, low-frequency radio receiver anywhere in the world, you hear strange sounds. But some of those sounds are characteristic and unique to the auroral zone. As a matter of fact, some of those sounds in the background
now. Yeah, that's how you hear noises.
And some people believe that these sounds are actually generated by the auroral particles as they enter the Van Allen zones and stream down the lines of force of the Earth's magnetic field.
The noises that we have heard have been noises that come because we have taken radio signals and put them through a radio receiver, and that's how we've heard them. But there are people who claim to hear noises at the time that there is an auroral display. So is there any scientific basis on this? Has this been observed?
It doesn't seem likely that you can hear a direct sound from the aurora.
From 1956 to 1985, scientists from the Canadian and US armies launched over 3,000 rockets in the sky of Churchill, a remote northern Manitoba community. Their main goal was to study the effects of northern lights on human activity. The researchers made, however, an unexpected discovery. A peculiar pattern hidden amongst the electromagnetic waves. The sound of the Aurora Borealis. 40 years later, two lovers and documentarists preoccupied about the fate of the world leave for Churchill on a quest to record the sound of the Northern Lights. Both secretly hoping to hear them with bare ears. And in doing so, to bring back some magic into the world. This is that forgotten need to probe the sky. After a two-day train ride, heading north through the boreal forest and the taiga, to the extreme limits of the Canadian Shield, way above the 58th parallel north, our two documentarists finally reached Churchill. There they immediately hop on a snowmobile and follow inland the great Missinipee River, leaving behind the windy shores of the Hudson Bay. Their destination? A cabin in the wilderness, where they'll attempt to record the sound of the Northern Lights for the first time.
Here's home, guys.
All right. That's pretty cool.
Is that a map of the area?
That is, yeah.
So we are... And this is the Hudson Bay.
Okay. Yeah, so we're right there. Orford Lake.
Just to... Lucky.
Churchill is located on the path of one of the world's most important polar bears' migratory route. And while in winter time polar bears are usually hunting far out on the icy Hudson Bay, there's always a lethal risk of coming across a solitary male in the tundra.
There's two roads in Churchill. One road comes down here, Sierra 30,
yeah,
and then there's another road. Follows the coast to right there to the city center. And that's it.
Okay.
That's all we
and this is the train.
Yeah, and that's the train.
Oh, yeah.
And then the hydro line follows the train.
Okay. So how far are we from Churchill? Just to, you said 25 kilometers?
I'd say probably 30 kilometers.
30 kilometers.
To capture the sound of the aurora without any interference, the two documentarists have to get away from the city and all its electricity.
I keep mentioning that because when I heard what you guys were here for, I was like, oh, so they're trying to prove the old wives' tale that you can hear the Northern Lights, because you know, some people say like they can hear them crackling when it's really quiet, and some people are like, that's bullshit. But you never know. I mean, I don't know.
I can actually show you our gear. Are you curious?
Kind of.
Auroras produce three distinct sounds. First, the auroral chorus, which sounds like electronic singing birds.
It's a homemade. A friend of us that is a mechanic and a bit of a self-taught caller made this.
Next, the spherics. Crackling sounds like lightning strikes.
So you put this and you just do this. And normally, we're going to be able to record the sound of the Northern Lights.
Ah, cool.
Finally, the whistlers. A sound that have been described by witness as a peculiar single note, a bit like a magnet that fragments into several colors.
But, I mean, this is an experiment.
Old-timers have all sorts of ridiculous stories.
Yeah.
Like they say, because back in the day, I used to just sit out here and listen to radio because they didn't have anything else, so they'd have radios playing.
Yeah.
And they say that when the Northern Lights are crazy, sometimes you can, like, catch, like, your radio will be playing NCI, which is the only channel you get here, and then all of a sudden you'll start hearing, like, oh, suka blah, 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 like, Russians talking, and you're like, what the hell? They say that, but I don't know. That's old-timer stories.
As they lay silent on the frozen river, in minus 50 degrees Celsius weather, our two lovers turn their hopeful gaze toward the night sky. Their breath is suspended in the crisp air. They wait, their ears straining for the faintest sound of the Northern Lights. Between them, a small metal box topped by a long antenna turned toward the cosmos, records the sidereal void.
Churchill on the southern rim of the Arctic was chosen as the launch site when the program began in 1959 because of its uninterrupted view of the upper atmosphere.
three, two, one, fire, plus one, plus two, plus three, plus four, plus five.
In 3.5 minutes, it's 100 miles above the Earth, sending back its messages.
The lovers emerge from the wilderness after two whole nights spent under the northern sky. Their first attempt failed. They recorded only static. The auroras remained silent. The following days, the two documentarists go around town and ask the residents, "Is it possible to hear the northern lights? Has anyone ever heard their sound? Where? And how?" Many laugh at them, but some make echo of an old tale, a rumor according to which it is possible under the right sky, in the right weather, at the right moment, to hear the sky's song with your own ears.
Well, I don't know if there's a sound. Not unless you're way out in the wilderness and you can't hear anything. Maybe there is sound. I don't really know.
I'm not too sure whether I've heard them or just the sounds of nature.
Now, there's so much noise in the world that you really need to be isolated from everything else. And maybe that's what it is all about, to pick it up. You got to focus on it.
Eventually, they cross paths with a man dressed in a simple jacket.
Yeah.
His hands bare, his hair flowing freely in the freezing wind. A man who claims to be the king of the north.
If I was a sheriff in this town...
The man offers to lead them to his childhood friend, an old Inuk, who has lived all his life under the northern sky and knows the secret of its singing nights.
Come inside!
We have the boots.
Yeah, come inside.
Should we remove them?
No. Come inside.
Hi. Nice to meet you. I'm Nicola.
Nicola?
Yeah.
Harry Tutu.
Harry Tutu. We heard a lot about you.
Yeah. Hello.
Hi.
Eloise.
Come on.
Yeah? Yeah. No problem.
Don't worry about your boots. Don't worry about your boots. Right.
Thanks a lot for having us.
I think they'd rather have a shot of vodka.
Good.
Want a shot?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, God right. I'm glad you agreed to that. You too?
Yeah, why not?
Oh, sure.
Enter. Entree. So, you go sit up. Go sit up.
We're doing a radio documentary.
Radio?
Radio. So only sound. And the main project is to come here and record the sound of the Northern Lights.
Oh, okay.
Try to.
Well, you won't catch them.
No. Why so?
Because we're too far south.
Go sit down over here. Okay.
Stand.
Sit down.
I grew up under the Northern Lights. I used to watch them all the time, ever since I was a little boy. My people, my culture, we want them to come, we'll whistle. And then keep on whistling until they come, and then when it gets bright, then when you get scared of them, you rub your fingernails together. You rub your nails together, and that makes them go away. So that's the Inuk. The Inuk story about Northern Lights, eh? And if you whistle too long, it'll come down, it'll cut your head off, and it'll play with it up in the sky. That's what happens if you whistle too long at Northern Lights.
What do you feel like when you see them? Does anything come to your mind?
When I see the Northern Lights, I think of my history. I think of my people, my past, and all those people that are gone, and I know it's going to go on and on and on and on, like a deep feeling inside. It's just like Like going to a grave, that's what it kind of represents. And when I see them, I feel proud. I feel happy that I'm here and alive with them. And I know someday I'll be up there dancing with them. Hey.
Someday you'll be in the Northern Lights too.
Someday.
Thank you. In the sky. That's where I'm gonna go when I die.
This is a year of tremendous solar activity, flares and sunspots, the peak of the sun's 11-year cycle. That increased magnetic activity can burn out transformers and power lines, disrupt long-distance telecommunications, and distort radio waves. It also creates the aurora borealis. Electrons tumbling from the sun crash into the Earth's atmosphere, making a river of light that flows across the sky, the solar wind made visible.
Magnetic disturbances created by the Northern Lights could produce some minor interfering currents in the brain or the nervous system, which might disrupt normal human behavior.
You're at ease with us going in there.
Technically, we're not allowed to. I was just thinking that. I'm very happy to go inside. We'll just have to check. There's a few different places where you can get into it. Yep. So we'll just have to check the snowbanks if I can.
Yeah. We don't care about.
Yeah. Just don't say I took you there.
Yeah.
You can post it. Do whatever you want. I don't
care.
All right.
Yeah.
We are on the tundra right beside Hudson Bay with a lot of little trees, and they're all windswept. Because we have a prevailing wind off the bay from the north. Yeah, just rocky Canadian shields with tons of little trees.
On one side, what do we see on the horizon or on our left?
So just over here, there was just a huge explosion and no one knew what the heck it was, and got back to town later that night and talked to the cop in town, and he's like, oh yeah, the SWAT team was in town and they came to blow up some unexploded ordnance. So along this whole shore of Hudson Bay, there's all sorts of unexploded ordnance from when the U.S. military was here. So they're still being found regularly, which is kind of concerning, but... So all the little trails that go between this road and the bay, they'll all have signs that say caution, unexploded ordnance.
Driving across the frozen plains, the two documentarists eventually make out a couple of strangely shaped buildings. These large concrete and steel structures are the remains of the rocket research range.
So we can walk from here if you guys want to go check it out. Or if you don't want to, that's fine too.
I'd like to go in.
Yeah?
Sure.
Okay, let's do it.
It's from there that the US and Canadian military launched their rockets to the sky for 40 years.
It kind of feels very much like some sort of moon installation. Very much science fiction feel to it, but in a slow decay. Churchill was chosen as a place because it was very far north and there was a lot of auroral activity there. And the military was really interested in this because the auroral activity, the magnetic shield and the aurora, could play havoc with navigational systems for missiles.
Skybird, this is Dropkick.
From the ground, the Northern Lights are hauntingly beautiful. But when they show up on a radar screen, they can cause confusion and panic. Strong auroras have been known to interfere with early warning radar systems.
So they wanted to understand how it worked and what the limitations were for them if they're going to bomb Russia.
It would be disastrous to interpret some of these extra signals as enemy fighters approaching, for example. So radar systems are subject to danger from the distortions introduced by the Northern Lights.
And then there's later, you have this attempt to actually change the aurora borealis, to affect it physically. And this was called Project Waterhole. So they sent up a rocket with 100 kilograms of explosives, basically H2O molecules, water, and exploded it in the aurora borealis band. Within 2 seconds, they had created a 40 kilometer wide hole in the aurora borealis. They don't know why it happened so fast. The hole lasted for about 3 minutes and then started to sort of collapse again. And they did this a few times over the next four or five years. And really, on one level, they're not trying to destroy anything here. They're just trying to understand it better. But that need to physically touch something and understand it more and probe more is so ingrained in scientific inquiry and so much part of our curiosity as humans.
Are you on frequency? Okay, right.
All right, come on, safety, agree, boy.
Impact area clear.
I think I'm not surprised by it, but at the same time, if you first hear about it, you are surprised by it, that they would actually attempt something like this.
82.5.
In the 80s, after several decades of research, the government shut down the rocket research range to pursue more lucrative scientific endeavors. The first golden age of space exploration was slowly coming to an end, and we collectively stopped dreaming of the sky.
You never know what's going to be useful when you do science. I mean, sometimes you do, obviously, but sometimes you just don't know. On one hand, it's very much a shame that that pure curiosity was just not supported, you know. That's what makes science, that's what makes knowledge.
Janvier 2023, on s'en va enregistrer le son des aurores boréales.
That very night, amidst the ruins of the rocket range, the two documentarists attempt to record the sound of the Northern Lights for a second time. Where the scientists succeeded before them, perhaps they will succeed too.
Ça, c'est notre enregistreuse. Qui, dont tous les fils sont gelés. Il fait moins 44 en ce moment. Tout est gelé. Puis tout a comme... c'est un peu déloussé.
They start their device with frozen fingers and wait expectantly. Their bodies numbed by the cold. They wait. And wait again. No result. Only the resounding silence above them. On the far edges of Churchill sits a small wooden house covered in caribou's antlers. This house is the home of a man who claims to have heard the Northern Lights with his bare ears.
Doug.
We were admiring their caribou antler.
Ah!
Are you the one who hunted them?
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, thanks for having us. We didn't mean to intrude or anything. We were just, you know, I don't know how much we told you of our project the other day. I don't think we had the chance to tell you that much, did we?
I don't think so.
So
let's put it this way. If you did, he wouldn't remember.
Oh,
all right. He has very short-term memory.
Oh,
all right. At
that point. Okay, all right.
That's why I have to keep an eye on everything.
Oh, thank God you're here, then.
Inside, the air is warm. The smell of roasted onions fills the room. The walls are decorated with numerous taxidermy ducks, fish and martens. A black bear pelt adorns the living room, where the trapper's wife is hunched over a 2,000-piece puzzle.
We've told you we came to record the sound of Northern Lights, and I know some people think we're crazy. What do you think?
Great. I like it. I can lay in my tent there when they do come up and listen to them and watch them dance. It's great.
What's the song like?
Oh, geez, that's hard to explain. More of a static noise than not crackling, just light noise. You can hear it, but nothing really sharp. At least I haven't heard anything really sharp. Well, I don't know what kind of noise that makes. Just like a crackling sound. To me, anyways.
Could you do it for us?
Jesus. No, I can't.
Did you miss it?
Oh, yeah, but now that I had heart problems, I can't go out anymore. No, but every chance I get, I like to be out in the land, that's for sure.
What do you miss the most about it?
Oh, being out. Going to the land. Looking at country. Going for a ride.
You seem like you had a great life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, jeez, yes.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. Can't complain. If I complain, the old lady will kick me out.
So what are you two guys doing? What about you, John? What are you occupying your days with?
This.
And what about you, Chris? What do you spend your days doing?
Sitting on that chair and watching TV.
What are your favorite programs?
Oh, Jesus. The hunting shows, fishing. When I was younger, though, I'd never watch TV. I'd be out in the land.
Do you look at the Northern Lights?
Oh, yes, when they're out. Oh, yes, I love them. I get the kick out of them. Yeah.
Especially at that window over there watching them. Really?
Yeah, when they get nice and bright here. Oh, they come out. Yeah.
What do you like about them?
Oh, just the crackle and the waves they make and the colors. It's good. Good to watch.
And as the two documentarists are on their way out the door, the man is already sitting on his chair by the window, waiting for his old celestial friends to come visit and dance before his eyes. There, every night, he hopes to hear their song once again. Just once. That night, the two documentarists mount their snowmobile and ride toward the unknown, leaving the city behind. Far up the Churchill River, encouraged by the image of the frail old man at his window, they set up their equipment one last time. And wait, under the glimmering lights of the auroras. There, for the first time since they arrived in Churchill, they think back of the man who built the recording device, resting on the ice between them. Long ago, that man spent hours upon hours attempting to hear the Northern Lights, only to end up listening to the sound of silence. But the man didn't despair. Instead, he began to give less and less importance to the actual sound of the auroras. He began to cherish these long moments spent isolated from the world, waiting, listening, his eyes turned toward the sky. In these moments, he found magic. And right there, at the place where the horizon starts to bend, the two documentarists found magic too. Just listen to That Forgotten Need to Probe the Sky, a sound documentary produced and directed by Héloïse de Mer-Spinard and Nicolas Lachapelle, in dialogue with the composer Welcome John, inspired by the visionary works of Tom de Mers and Peter Medler, with the voices of Jeremy Allen, George Alexander St. Clair, Harry Tutuk, James Wells, Roland Sawatzki and Chris Campbell. Narration by Jacqueline Vandegeer. Field research by Alan James Rioux Dubé. Archival research by Emma Brunet. Sound design and mix by Antonin Wyss. Linguistic revision by Maureen Roberge. Graphic design by Max Reo and Criterion Design Bureau. The archives are from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and the Library and Archives Canada. Thanks to the financial support of Canada Council for the Arts, Le Conseil des Arts et Lettres du Québec, the Polar Bear Holding Facility, the Royal Legion, and the Itzanitak Museum.
That's your Canada Land. I hope you liked it. You can email me about it. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. I'm also posting at Blue Sky if you care to follow me there. Today's episode was written and reported by Nicholas LaChapelle and Eloise Demers-Pinard. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio assistance from Caleb Thompson. Max Collins is Canada Land's director of audio. I'm the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the news. We will update you on the Prime Minister's latest tactical achievements. Mostly, we'll be talking about some dodgy reporting on the gig economy. And finally, we'll dare to look at a topic that we have been neglecting for too long on this show.
Your Canada Land podcast doesn't talk enough about cellos.
Wait for that. All right, Jan Wong will join me in a minute, but first things first, got to give you some updates on the ongoing situation in Ottawa. Our prime minister is scrambling to hold on. He's doing damage control after Freeland's exit. To set the table here, even before all this went down, the Trudeau cabinet was a bit of a skeleton crew. There were ministers performing double duty. Then, you know, his housing minister, Sean Fraser, announced that his time was coming up. He would be leaving. That's just the housing ministry, not an important one these days. So that was already the state of play when Trudeau was trying to shuffle Freeland out as finance minister. And I guess he thought that Carney was in, but new details about how this all went down on that Zoom call. Trudeau seemed to have been confident that Carney was going to take the job. But of course, after Freeland did not do as she was told and deliver the fall economic statement and instead quit, Carney didn't want it anymore. CBC reported that industry minister François-Philippe Champagne was asked to take the finance job. He took himself out of the running before. Finally, Dominic LeBlanc was the one who was installed as emergency finance minister, also holding portfolios as the Minister of Public Safety and the Minister of Intergovernmental Affairs. Also, of course, previously Justin Trudeau's babysitter. I'm told he picks out Trudeau's novelty socks. He's helping the prime minister with his Hinge profile. This guy's up for anything. He's a trooper. It's just too much for one man. And so the news has emerged, leaks again, that according to the CBC, a consequential cabinet shuffle. That's expected later today. This episode's coming out on Friday, December 20th. At least 10 ministers will be moved around to new portfolios. The Hill Times is looking into their crystal ball and pre-reporting that it will be MPs Miller, Anand, and McKinnon who will each get new portfolios. All of this indicating that, yeah, the PM is trying to hang on. He is frantically rearranging the deck chairs. Monday's rumors of an imminent resignation announcement, that fizzled away. Instead, we have a slew of headlines about how Trudeau is taking the time to reflect. He's calling up old friends, asking for advice, thinking it over. One thing he ain't doing, however, is talking to the press. Now, you will remember that in years past, some critics, like me, called the Prime Minister's year-end fireside chat sit-downs, the one-on-ones that were held with the big players in legacy media, as bullshit. These were snowball interviews that were really intended to provide the appearance of accountability to the press. And this is not a specific Trudeau complaint. I think Stephen Harper was the prime minister who really pioneered the practice of providing like next to no availability to the press, but then sitting down at a time when nobody could care less for an interview that was designed to provide the least challenging questions possible. Very cynical criticism from me that I think has been completely confirmed, because right now, when the country actually does have challenging questions for our prime minister, every single year-end sit-down interview has been canceled. Former columnist, current cellist, and reigning Canada Land champion, Jan Wong. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. I'm only on book two of Suzuki. I'm a beginner cellist.
Ah, the Suzuki method.
Well, the mail is starting to move again as postal workers head back to the job across Canada today after a month-long strike. But many are frustrated about that back-to-work order and the lack of a new contract.
Jen, after 4 weeks on strike, Canada Post was ordered back to work by the Canada Industrial Relations Board following a request by Federal Labour Minister Stephen McKinnon. I mean, as I speak, he's still the Federal Labour Minister. Who knows? Yeah, so Canada Post was back to work on Tuesday. As CBC reports, they were working under their existing contracts, which have been extended until May to allow the bargaining process to resume. Understandably, the union was not happy about this. In a statement, they said it is unlawful and that constitutional challenge to this process is scheduled for mid-January. Our fight for justice is far from over. Since the last two postal strikes ended this way, I guess it's not surprising that this happened. I am surprised that the government waited this long to intervene, given how the negotiations were going. So that is the news with our legacy courier service. It's got me in a labor news frame of mind, all of this stuff. And I think, you know, Canada Post was playing the holidays, you know, and I wonder if they played themselves, because they were like, see how much you like the holidays without Canada Post, people. And I think a lot of people are like, we do not notice your absence. Anyhow, labor reporting was in the air, and I noted, as a lot of journalists did, with plaudits and appreciation, this major story from the Toronto Star. It was getting a lot of praise. And it was about the plight of a different set of delivery people, Uber Eats couriers.
I'm Gada. I am a labor reporter at the Toronto Star, and I spent the last 6 weeks delivering Uber Eats. Our goal was to find out more about how the app works and the conditions under which a lot of the delivery workers, the conditions under which they work.
Here is some of the response. Journalist Emma McIntosh saying, meticulous, devastating, infuriating story. You've got to read this one. Saba Aitazaz at The Star, if you read one thing this weekend, read this incredible investigation by Gada Sharif into the shadowy aspects of a controversial gig economy. Jim Stanford, world-class investigative journalism by Gada Al-Sharif for Toronto Star. 6 weeks undercover as an Uber Eats worker. I also felt like this is really something like, I'm glad we have a Toronto Star that still cares about labor and will still invest. I mean, you did undercover work as a maid, Jan. Actually sending somebody in to represent the voices of workers who don't often get represented. So I read this and I think my jaw like hung open as I read that in 6 weeks working as a undercover Uber Eats courier, Gada averaged $1.74 per hour online. I guess that's like with the app.
Oh. Yeah, there's a lot of numbers there. And so I also thought, wow, 6 weeks. Because I worked as a maid for 4 weeks, but then I kept reading it and it got really confusing. First of all, I think it's great to do this story, but it's not really 6 weeks. If I was the editor, I would have said, you can't say 6 weeks, because it was 140 hours on the app.
Uh-huh.
So that works out, too, if my math is correct, about 23 hours a week. So that's the first thing.
If you think of a 40-hour work week, that's more of like, you know,
it's half time.
Yeah. So is it? Did you work 6 weeks or did you work 3 weeks over a six-week period?
And I think her delivery time was very little. It was only 15 hours. Now, it became that the story becomes, oh, you can't get any orders.
No trips, no deliveries, no orders. I am not getting any orders.
I got zero deliveries.
I have had zero deliveries. I
haven't gotten any deliveries. I've been on since about 5:30, 5-ish.
They talk about online hours. She was online for a long time. Her online hour is the 174. I kept looking at the numbers. So it's like you having the website on, right? You're getting $1.74 an hour. The engaged hours is what Uber calls it. And I want to talk about engaged hours. She made $15.41 before tip. And her tip was about $1.30. So if you're really going to do the math, that's almost $17 for each engaged hour.
For the engaged, which is like when she's actually biking?
When she's making a delivery. And that's almost the minimum wage. It's not quite. So I just want to point that out. I found it really confusing. I had to take notes and then put them together.
You read this critically, like somebody who is a journalist and somebody who's done this kind of work before.
Yeah. So when I did the maid thing, first of all, it was full time.
Uh-huh.
But we also had this problem of engaged hours. So that's why I was thinking about it. So the owner of the company paid us only for the hours we were mopping floors in a house, which was very annoying because we would have a 10-hour workday, but physically working 6 hours. Why? Because we're traveling between the houses, and the houses were not in the same neighborhood, so sometimes it would take a long time. So on my day off, I called the Ministry of Labor in Ontario, and I said, so is this legal? Like, I'm only getting paid for the hours that I'm mopping. I'm not getting paid for the hours that I'm actually driving or being in the car. I was the driver. We drove the team around, but nobody's getting paid. I'm not getting paid. And they said, no, if you're going between jobs, you're supposed to get paid. So in other words, our engaged time was the only time the employer paid us, but that's actually illegal. So it's interesting to me that Uber can have an app like this and the online is typically, is that like work time?
Now, I know that if you commute to work, your time to work and home is not considered like time
correct
that your employer has to pay you for.
Ministry of Labor says you don't get paid for that.
Ministry of Labor says that's not work hours. That's getting to work and back.
Correct.
But while you're on the job, if there's travel to get to and from a work site, you're at work. You're not doing anything else.
You're at work.
Right.
If your boss tells you to go send this message, you know, to the office building down the block, you don't clock off.
Right.
You're at work.
Now, that was relevant in your experience when you were undercover as a maid. And I think the point is a valid one, that all that time should be compensated, and only paying a maid for the time when they're actually doing the maid work is basically wage theft.
Yeah, garbage.
Now, the question here is, when Gada writes about engaged hours and online hours, does it mean the same thing? Does it mean what she was paid for while she was on her bike doing Uber Eats, whether or not she had an order, whether
right
or not, I mean, that, you know, that would be, I think, legitimate to say, look, I hit the ground in Toronto with my bike looking for orders, and I worked for 8 hours, and here's the average. Sometime I was driving somewhere so I could get an order because I was close to restaurants.
Yeah.
Sometimes I was actually doing an order. Or what is this weird term, online hours?
Yes.
Because if you've got an app open, that is not the same thing as being necessarily on the job.
No, it's not the same as being a maid driving from house to house. So it is a very gray area. It's kind of like a really crafty work structure that Uber has created, so they don't have to pay you. She writes about circling around and around. She's trying to figure out how to get more jobs, which is very interesting. is it better to keep moving around, or is it better to just stay put in some so-called hot area?
I thought that, you know, I could hang out in one of these hotspots that is indicated on the app, and I could go and, you know, just hang out there and I'd get orders. And that very quickly became obvious that that was not going to be the case. I was very confused the first week about why I wasn't getting orders.
It's fascinating because I didn't know anything about Uber drivers.
I mean, this is fascinating for like a half a dozen reasons. There's so many things she's looking at that should be looked at about what is happening with the algorithm. And she looks at things like different people are given different pay for the same job when they're offering you an order.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And how they incentivize you. And there are people who say that they give you better pay when you start to get you hooked, but then they start to decrease it. Or do they reward you for doing lots of orders? How? Because it's a total mystery. There's all kinds of interesting stuff. And like when you're talking about labor law with the gig economy, we don't have regulations like that get into the guts of what the algorithm is doing.
Yeah, labor law has not caught up to gig economy.
All of this stuff should be investigated, but the big takeaway that people have and what runs in like the headline and what everybody's tweeting about is $1.74 an hour?
But that's not really true.
We should be careful not to ascribe that to the reporter, because that sounds like the kind of thing that an editor would seize upon.
Yeah, let's blame editors. I agree.
Jan, what would you like to duly note today?
I'd like to talk about the airlines and their new fees, which are junk fees. Like they're trying to, if you buy the lowest price fare now, I think it's going to start in January. If you want to bring on a bag, a carry-on, you now have to pay a fee. And before, you used to be able to choose your seat. If you waited 24 hours before your flight took off, you could not have to pay. Now you have to pay if you want to choose a seat at any time. But the real reason I want to talk about the airlines is Air Canada and cellos, because your Canada Land podcast doesn't talk enough about cellos. And I think you're missing a huge news story.
I get trolled for this online every day from the cello community.
Yeah, I'm trolling you for cellos, yeah. I'm gonna put out an alert to the cello community. So there was a concert, supposedly, last week at Kerner Hall, which is the best acoustics in Toronto.
Beautiful sound at Kerner Hall, yeah.
It's fantastic. And there's a cellist called Sheku Kanamason. He's a British cellist. Young, 25 years old, and he was going to be playing a concert at Kerner with his sister, a pianist, and 1,000 people bought tickets, including me. And at the last minute, we got an email saying he wasn't allowed to bring his cello on board the flight, and so he's can't come, and we're really sorry. And 200 people didn't get the email and showed up. So I was interested in Air Canada's policy, because Sheku bought a ticket. You have to buy a ticket for your cello.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't fit in the overhead.
And they still wouldn't let him bring it in.
No. And it doesn't weigh a lot. I play cello. I know exactly how tall it is.
It looks heavy. It's not. It doesn't weigh a lot?
Yeah. It's think of balsa wood. It's like a balsa wood plane. It's actually very light. It's the case that can be heavy, but it's no more than 10 kilos, right? You're buying a seat.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're paying half price because you don't have airport fees and you don't eat. The cello doesn't eat. Doesn't go to the bathroom. So it's half price. Great. But he wasn't allowed. So I went on the Air Canada website and it says all this. It says you can. So I just like to send a shout out to Air Canada. Can you stop doing that? And is it because he's young and black?
Huh.
No, actually it isn't. Other cellists also have trouble, but I don't think it helps that he's young and black. Oh, he's a superstar. When he was 18, he played at Harry and Meghan's wedding. And then he went on to win Male Artist of the Year and Critics' Choice Award in the UK. So he's a superstar. Anyway, he's really great.
My read of this story, which is like very frustrating and idiotic, you would hope that just somebody with a brain would make a different call. I think that they had some excuse that like that 50% instrument fee is like if you pre-book a ticket for your instrument and then there was like some flight was canceled and he had to make alternate arrangements really quickly and the whole, you know, they weren't familiar with the cello.
It's true. His earlier flight on American was canceled because of weather. So the 9 hours in the airport, he books Air Canada, he buys a ticket, and the Air Canada website says you can do this.
Yeah.
You can even get pre-boarding. You can board between zone one and zone two so that, you know, your cello doesn't get stomped on by all those crazy passengers fighting for overhead. He doesn't take any overhead. It's taking a seat that he pays for.
Let the man and his cello on the plane.
Yeah, and it's a $4.5 million cello, so he's not going to check it. Yeah, cellos cost a lot. And when you're really good, someone loans it to you.
Duly noted. That is our show for today, and barring any unforeseen dramatic developments, that is a wrap on our media criticism for 2024, but it is not our last podcast. Great lineup of stuff you won't want to miss if you're looking for something to listen to while you're traveling or hanging out over the holidays. You can email me about today's show at jesse@canadaland.com. I'm on Blue Sky, might even be posting over the holidays if I can't help myself. Jan, I know that you are on a social media sabbatical, so instead, why not tell people about a great Jan Wong book that they can buy as a gift to a loved one over the holidays?
I have the perfect book. It's called Apron Strings, and it's travels with my son, and we do home cooking in France, Italy, and China. So it's a great present for your mom or a great present for your kid or anyone. It's lots of fun, and it's delicious, and I have recipes.
It's a great book for foodies who like excellent writing. This episode is produced by James Nicholson, mixing and mastering by Caleb Thompson. Our director of audio is Max Collins. Lucy Lamonier did the fact check for this episode. I'm Jesse Brown, the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Thank you.